Thank you very much, Professor Wolf. A very insightful analysis of one of the less common parts of de Tocqueville's writings. I found it extremely intriguing. Our next speaker is Dr. James McClellan. Many of us know him from his work as director of the Center for Judicial Studies, from his books on Joseph Story and the American Constitution, from his student edition of The Federalist, and his co-editing with Mel Bradford of Debates on the Ratification of the Constitution. He has recently been appointed as Director of Publications for the Liberty Fund, from which post we look forward to an increasing and ever more insightful flow of scholarly writings from that source. Dr. McClellan today is going to talk on Lord Bryce as an American observer.
Thank you, Danny. It was in 1888, more than a century ago, that James Bryce wrote his book entitled The American Commonwealth. And almost from the moment of conception, the book was viewed as a classic. In 1938, when its 50th anniversary was celebrated, Henry Steele Cominger observed that Bryce's American Commonwealth remains the most comprehensive, judicious, and realistic analysis of the late 19th century in our literature. And this assessment is no less true today. Like Tocqueville's Democracy in America, the book has certain qualities that give it longevity and vitality, allowing it to teach rising generations of the America we know today something about the America we lost, something about ourselves that is enduring through the ages, and something about our strengths and weaknesses as a people and as a nation. This is a book, then, that serves as a guide to an understanding of our present accomplishments and discontents and of our prospects for survival. And I might mention parenthetically that Liberty Fund will be publishing a new edition of this work either later this year or early next year with an introduction by Russell Kirk. Bryce's study of American culture compares favorably with Tocqueville's masterpiece, but the two works differ in so many ways that it is difficult to draw meaningful parallel distinctions. Tocqueville, of course, wrote from the French point of view, Bryce from the Anglo-American. Tocqueville based his Democracy in America on a single visit in the 1830s during the presidency of Andrew Jackson, when sectionalism and coonskin democracy were on the rise, and when the size of the population and settled portions of the country were considerably smaller. Bryce, on the other hand, was a global traveler, sort of a professional tourist of sorts, and a frequent visitor to these parts, all the while he was sailing around the world gathering material for a number of books, including his book called Modern Democracies. He made his first visit in 1870, and subsequent trips in 1881, 1883, 1890, and 1901, and then between 1907 and 1913, he resided in the District of Columbia as British ambassador to the United States. He thus had a far better opportunity than Tocqueville to acquire firsthand knowledge of American institutions. It is also noteworthy that both Tocqueville and Bryce visited our shores during two different periods of political radicalism, the age of Jacksonian democracy and the progressive era. To what extent this colored or distorted their views and interpretations of our political system, if at all, is difficult to determine. Certainly both deplored the steady advance of absolute democracy, although as Woodrow Wilson observed in his review of Bryce's work, Tocqueville actually came to America, or came to view the American experiment to see how democracy works, whereas Bryce, coming some 50 years later, came to measure the influence of British civilization in America and to find out what sort of institutions the English had developed there. As Professor Cominger put it, Bryce was anxious to describe and understand, Tocqueville to warn. Bryce was sympathetic and optimistic, Tocqueville censorious and pessimistic. The critics are agreed that Tocqueville was the better stylist and that Democracy in America has more philosophical depth. But in other respects, Bryce probably surpassed his predecessor. He painted a broader and more detailed picture of the structure of American society and a much clearer view of actual life in America. In general, the book was favorably reviewed both in England and in the United States when it first appeared and praised for its clarity, for its comprehensiveness and fairness. In fact, there were only two disparaging reviews, both by American progressivists. They complained that Bryce had uncritically accepted the unrepresentative character of the Senate, which is based, of course, on the principle of state equality instead of political equality, and had failed to address the problems of big business and corporate corruption. Bryce's aristocratic background and his reverence for judicial review as a check on the tyranny of popular assemblies, however, is what really rankled his progressivist critics. Though long associated with liberal causes in Great Britain as a member of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and as a member of Gladstone's cabinet, Bryce, like Tocqueville before him, harbored many anti-democratic sentiments, and they colored the pages of the American Commonwealth from beginning to end. In reading this book, it is important to keep in mind, therefore, that even though Bryce was a defender of liberal causes in his own country, he often espoused the principles of conservative groups in the United States and commented disparagingly on populist efforts to bring all branches of the government under the yoke of the people. Mr. Bryce, moaned one well-to-do, socially prominent progressivist ex-congressman, sees America through the rim of a champagne glass, to the strains of soft music, and in the smiles of fair women. Published originally in London as a three-volume work, The American Commonwealth is divided into six parts. The first introduces the reader to the national and state systems of government. This comprises nearly half of the work. The part dealing with the states represents an important contribution to political science, for Bryce is truly the first to recognize the importance of state constitutional history and development in the study of the American political system. He had little to go on at the time, for Johns Hopkins University had only just established its famous political science department, and he had no vast body of political studies from which to draw. Outside of John Burgess at Columbia and Woodrow Wilson at Princeton, there were scarcely any political scientists in the country. This, of course, was an idyllic state of affairs, we can see today, but it must be admitted that in retrospect, Bryce's analysis of our state governments, written by a foreign observer without guidance or direction, was a remarkable achievement. Much of what Bryce wrote on state legislatures, executives, and judiciaries is outmoded today, principally because of increased democratization. And so it would seem that the most original section of the book may now be said to be the most obsolete. The section of his book on national government, on the other hand, was less satisfactory and immediately attracted the wrath of his critics. It was based in large measure on the writings of Thomas Cooley, the great constitutional commentator from Michigan, and thus reflected the unionist, big government bias of the Republican Party. Bryce's biographer, Fisher, freely conceded that Bryce's sketch of the national government was the least original part of the book. The constitutional historian, Charles G. Haynes, later commented that there is throughout the entire first volume of The American Commonwealth too great a dependence upon the views and in the interpretation of Alexander Hamilton. Bryce, to be sure, believed that Hamilton's mind is more independent and more commanding than Madison's, and he regretted that Madison often yielded to the influence of Thomas Jefferson. Not surprisingly, therefore, Bryce's treatment of federalism proved to be one of the major shortcomings of the book. He seemed to think that federalism was not a causative factor in the war between the states, and he had nothing to say about the historic struggle over loose versus strict construction, states' rights versus nationalism, or unionism versus nullification. One exasperated reviewer speculated that Bryce's difficulty with federalism stemmed from the fact that he apparently did not believe in it. At times, he could barely conceal his repulsion at the guttural crudity of state and local politics, and he denied the right of statehood for many Western territories on the ground that they were too primitive and culturally barren ever to deserve the status of sovereignty. Nevada, he described as a group of burnt-out mining camps. And he thought it unlikely that Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, New Mexico, or Arizona would ever or probably should ever achieve statehood. Completely misreading the trend of the times, he prophesied that the Dakotas may be ultimately destined to stand among the wealthiest and most powerful commonwealths in the Union. Noting that Bryce's understanding of our federal system was virtually indistinguishable from that reflected in Republican Party platforms of the late 19th century, Charles Haynes has properly concluded that Bryce's treatment of American federalism cannot be considered as true political science, for it explains and defends with respect to the determination of federal relations only one side of the major party conflict throughout American history. Bryce's failure to present either an instructive or balanced review of our federal system and his near total regard of the states' rights tradition in American politics are part of a larger problem of the book. This is Bryce's general lack of historical perspective, and in particular, his egregious and surprising neglect of the South. These are serious weaknesses permeating the entire work, notwithstanding the author's boast that he was proud of the fact that he had resisted the temptation of straying off into history. Three stout volumes tell how things are, complained Lord Acton, an admirer of Robert E. Lee and supporter of the Southern Confederacy, without telling how they came about. We are told, Acton continued, that the American of today regards his national institutions with a confidence sometimes grotesque. But this is a sentiment which comes down not from Washington and Jefferson, but from Grant and Sherman. We have to distinguish what the nation owes to Madison and Marshall and what it owes to the Army of the Potomac. Echoing these sentiments, Woodrow Wilson thought that Bryce's sparing use of history was the book's chief fault, and was especially critical of Bryce's inadequate view of the constitutional effects of the War of Secession. More recent critics of Bryce have unanimously agreed that neither his readings nor his travels equipped him to deal with the complexities of the South, and that he had little more than a passing acquaintance with that region. In the words of Henry Steele Commager, there can be no doubt that Bryce saw most of America through the glasses of Eastern liberals of the Godkin type. He did not know the Midwest or Far West, despite his extensive travels there, and most certainly did not know or understand the South. These weaknesses of the book should not blind us, however, to its strengths and virtues. Bryce's analysis of American party politics at the turn of the century has in particular enjoyed wide acclaim from the beginning. Parts 3 and 4 of the American Commonwealth, which acquaint the reader with our political parties and the role of public opinion, were thought by Woodrow Wilson to be the crowning achievement of the book. When Bryce published his first edition of the work in 1888, there was virtually no literature at all on American political parties. Tocqueville had devoted only one chapter to the parties of his day, concluding that America had great parties and they are all extinct. Bryce supplied 29 chapters, almost one-fourth of the whole book, and in doing so made the American party system a new field of study. Thus, the American Commonwealth may be seen as the first great treatise on the role of the party system in national and state politics in our country. This contribution, combined with his pioneering study of state government early in the work, renders the Scotsman, James Bryce, one of the principal founders of American political science. Parts 5 and 6, the concluding and in many ways the most interesting sections of the Commonwealth, cover a wide variety of subjects, including immigration, what Bryce called the Negro problem, laissez-faire capitalism, women's suffrage, democracy and equality, and most especially our political and social institutions. In reviewing these chapters today, we are struck by the fact that the United States described by Bryce at the beginning of this century has virtually disappeared. Bryce was running, of course, during a period of massive upheaval and drastic change. To keep pace with changing developments, he revised the book continuously from 1888 until the time of his death in 1922, and the book went through many, many editions. The first edition may now be seen as an obituary for the Gilded Age. So rapidly was America changing then as now that one observer thought Bryce's effort to capture the American spirit was actually futile. For Bryce, he reasoned, would have to bring out a new edition every 6 months just to keep pace. Bryce himself confessed that his book seemed destined to be short-lived. No one doubts that 50 years hence, he said, America will differ at least as much from what it is now as it differs now from what America was when Tocqueville described it. To read the book today, one historian observed in 1939, is like looking from a train window at a rapidly receding view. The America of which Bryce wrote is vanishing into the past more rapidly than most of us who knew the land now realize. This sturdy stronghold of liberty has tardily joined the rest of the world in the march towards security for the people through government regimentation. Since the America of 50 years ago has likewise faded from view, we must ask ourselves whether the American Commonwealth depicted by Bryce is today anything more than a political romance. The answer is an emphatic yes, of course, for there is an enduring relevancy to his book because of the stability of American character and American institutions, a stability that is observed in these pages as in the writings of many other foreign visitors to this land. Bryce, in fact, was fond of the American people and in flattering ways pictured us as good-natured, optimistic, intelligent, practical, conservative, religious without being superstitious, tolerant, industrious, and hardworking, characteristics also discussed in the writings of Tocqueville, but which today are going the way of the American bison. But Lord Bryce knew the dark side of American character as well. Among our faults, he thought our tendency to level down intelligence, our laxity in the enforcement of the law, the low moral level of our politics, and the concomitant mediocrity of political and professional life in America were our worst features. Nothing has changed much there, and we are left with the realization that we are simply losing what few virtues we once possessed. Bryce's chapter, Why Great Men Are Not Chosen President, is perhaps the most frequently discussed provision of the book nowadays, as virtually every presidential election confirms the truth of Bryce's observation. He attributed the mediocrity of our presidents to the fact that the proportion of individuals of first-rate ability drawn into politics is smaller in America than in European countries, and to the American preference for safe over brilliant candidates. Americans, he complained, do not value originality or profundity or a wide culture or knowledge, and instead like their candidates to be sensible, vigorous, and above all, magnetic. Nothing much has changed since Bryce wrote those words, but in light of present circumstances, it would seem that the title of this renowned chapter should be revised. We have long given up hope of a great man occupying the White House, and would be satisfied if he were at least decent and honest. This brings us finally to Bryce's concern about our future. He considered immigration, the passing of the frontier, the growing mobs in the cities, and the increasing maldistribution of the wealth as the greatest threats to our survival. But he was sanguine about our chances and thought that we would prevail because of what he called our elements of strength. These he identified as our strong religious faith, the absence of class hatred, the equal distribution of land, and the moderation of our thought, elements of strength which today are either gone with the wind or have been seriously compromised. In the final analysis, then, Bryce was overly optimistic, and we needed to radically revise the horoscope which he cast so hopefully and we found so comfortable 100 years ago. As the Jacobin madness of our time deepens, and we witness the sinister transformation of our country through unlimited immigration, the decline of respect for innocent human life, the collapse of justice, law, order, and safety, of family and community, the corruption of our professions, and the resurrection of privileged classes in the form of vast bureaucracies of government officials, and a new priestly class of educators preaching the superstition of egalitarianism, it behooves us to repair to James Bryce's American Commonwealth and begin to understand what we were and what we can yet become amidst our adversity. Thank you.